From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Trump has invited Russian President Vladimir Putin to the White House. That came as a surprise to U.S. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, who found out when he was being interviewed by NBC's Andrea Mitchell at the Aspen Security Forum yesterday.
We have some breaking news. The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again.
Vladimir Putin coming
to the...
Did I hear
you?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
Well, the BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us from Moscow. And Sarah, you heard Dan Coats' reaction there. Apparently, he did not know this invitation had been put out. What's the reaction in Moscow?
Well, so far, nothing officially. The Kremlin's keeping its cards close to its chest for now. The one person who has been asked about it directly is the Russian ambassador to the United States, Anatoly Antonov. He was actually at a discussion club here in Moscow today, and he was asked about it, and he said he hadn't seen any letter from Washington. But he did go on to sort of hint at the fact that that could be possibly on the cards when he said that Russia was very much open to that possibility, that it was very important to have a dialogue with Russia. And he said, though it was up to the Kremlin to decide exactly how many summits would be held and when those would be. So it looks like Russia has heard about it formally, but certainly if it has, it's not saying so publicly just yet.
Well, given that you've mentioned the Russian ambassador to the United States, let's talk a little bit more about what he has been saying about what came out of supposedly out of the Helsinki conversation that Trump and Putin had. This week, he's been saying that, quote, important verbal agreements were reached at the Helsinki meeting. What more is Russia claiming happened between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin?
There was a little bit more detail today after reports emerged that, in fact, President Putin had proposed a new solution to the conflict in Ukraine. Then Mr. Antonov, the ambassador to the United States, was asked about that. And he did confirm that proposals had been discussed, but he wouldn't go into any detail. Now, what has been what some sources have talked about is that there's this idea of holding a referendum in eastern Ukraine, this area where there is still an ongoing conflict. It's a conflict in which more than 10,000 people have died right at the heart of Europe, and it's still not resolved. So apparently Russia's come up with this idea for a referendum. That will be very, very controversial with Kiev, the Ukrainian authorities there. And at the moment, we've heard nothing officially, of course, from the United States, from Donald Trump, about what his position might be on that.
This is so strange. So coyness from Russia, and then here in the United States, we have the president backtracking on what he said at Helsinki about whether or not the Russians had interfered with the U.S. election, saying, I don't see why they wouldn't have, and then adding, well, maybe they didn't, and then maybe it was other people. I mean, how is Russia looking upon the scramble here in the United States to clarify what the president actually does believe about what happened in the 2016 election?
You know, there's a little bit of sneering, there's a little bit of mockery, and also there's a little bit of smugness, I think, in the Russian reaction. Most of the reaction we get is from state television, which is pretty much reflecting the official position here, in fact, entirely representing the official position here. And I think it's interesting. You know, Russia, when Donald Trump was elected, was pretty elated. They thought that this was the man that they could do business with, who could restore relations. And then for the last 18 months, they've been pretty much on hold, waiting for this summit to take place. Finally, that happened. It all seemed very positive for Russia. And then there's been, as you say, all this kind of backtracking and confusion and chaos in the aftermath. So, you know, I think there are various sort of Russian interpretations of that. I think Russia still hopes that Donald Trump will come through for Moscow and sees positive signs of that in some of the things he said most lately. And of course, in this possible invitation for Vladimir Putin to Washington. But I think at the same time, you know, this chaos kind of suits Russia as well, because Russia sees itself very much as a global player, as one of the great powers, as it keeps saying. And I think to see the other great power, or one of them, the greatest power, the United States, in this kind of chaotic and weak position, I think suits Russia pretty well, too.
I guess there's this feeling that Vladimir Putin maybe has to do very little for him to maintain his presence squarely back on the world stage now.
Russia, I think, is pretty happy with the way things are going. If there is a second summit, that would be fantastic for Russia. It would be a major diplomatic victory, I think. Watching Russian TV coverage here, they say that Donald Trump has been called all sorts of things, from a wet noodle to Putin's poodle. But now they're saying Mr. Trump, this is state TV here, saying Mr. Trump is now showing his true colours. He's showing his best possible side by inviting Vladimir Putin. So I think, there is a fair degree of self-satisfaction here at the moment.
Well, that's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford speaking to us from Moscow. Sarah, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
In an interview broadcast today, President Trump told CNBC's Joe Kernan that he is ready to impose tariffs on all U.S. imports from China worth more than $500 billion.
We're down a tremendous amount. I raised 50, and they matched us. I said, you don't match us. You can't match us, because otherwise we're always going to be behind
would
the eight
ball. Would you ever get to 500, though?
To go to 500.
With the midterms on the horizon, what if the stock market were to go
down?
Well,
I actually think that's, if it does, it does. Look, I'm not doing this for
20%?
Politics. I'm doing this to do the right thing for our country. We have been ripped off by China for a long time.
NPR business reporter Jim Ciroli joins us now. Jim, the president has already imposed tens of billions of dollars of tariffs on Chinese goods. China has matched those tariffs with their own against the U.S. Do you think it's likely that he's going to do what he just said there and put tariffs on all more than $500 billion worth of Chinese imports?
Well, I mean, if you had asked me a few months ago, I would have said it was not very likely. But the president seems determined to do this, despite the fact that he's getting a lot of pushback from other countries, from American businesses, from farmers, from other Republicans. I mean, he has these views of trade as kind of a zero-sum game. He looks at at bilateral trade deficits, which is something economists really of all stripes say you shouldn't do. These are his views. He's had them a long time. And in the White House, he surrounded himself with people who also have very hawkish views on trade, like Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer,
right.
The Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. And so, maybe this is all part of some grand negotiating strategy. But for now, they're not showing any signs of backing down.
Well, when it comes to those farmers that you mentioned who are feeling the heat of these tariffs on the products that they are putting out from this country and selling to China, the president says that it's the trade deals, not the trade war, that is hitting the farmers. He writes, farmers have been on a downward trend for 15 years. The price of soybeans has fallen 50% since 5 years before the election. A big reason is bad trade deals with other countries. Is that true?
Prices for commodities are always volatile, but farm prices were pretty high all over the world, really, during around 2013, during Obama's second term. There's no question they have fallen sharply since around May. That's the price for soybeans. And it's hard to get around the fact that this is in direct response to President China's tariffs. I mean, you talk to farmers, they're really concerned. Soybeans are just a huge cash crop in the United States, and that is because of the growth of Asia. I mean, the Asian middle class is larger. Mm-hmm. They want to eat more meat. And, hogs eat soybeans. So this has become very profitable for the U.S. And a lot of farmers are worried that China is now going to start looking around for other markets.
President Trump also made some comments about the Fed that are getting a lot of attention today. The head of the White House Budget Office, Mick Mulvaney, said today that the president is not trying to influence the Federal Reserve. But here's what the president said. Here's what he said when he was asked about the Fed's recent rate hikes.
I'm not thrilled. Because, we go up and every time you go up, they want to raise rates again. And I don't really I am not happy about it. But at the same time, I'm letting them do what they feel is best.
Now, the Fed is supposed to be an independent agency. And by the way, this is what the president said before he became president about interest rates, which were kept very low after the financial crisis. And that was during the tenure of, Ben Bernanke and then former Fed chair Janet Yellen. Here's what the president said back in September of 2016.
Well, it's staying at zero because she's obviously political and she's doing what Obama wants her to do. And I know that's not supposed to be the way it is, but that's why it's low.
So he didn't like low interest rates then. Now he likes them.
Yeah, right.
Your thoughts?
Well, and the view – that was the view among a lot of Republicans during the Obama years. They said the Fed was keeping rates too low. They didn't like all the things the Fed was doing to stimulate growth. They warned about inflation. That never really took off. And Trump was among those people who said that. Now he's changed course. And that's, you know, not surprising. All presidents like the Fed to keep rates low because when rates get too high, it slows growth and they don't want to preside over a slowing economy. So a lot of them haven't liked interest rate increases. But there has been this tradition, at least over the past 25 years or so, of presidents not talking about Fed policy, just not talking about that or the value of the dollar. And Trump is changing that, just as he has with so many things.
One more thing, just in the 30 seconds or so we have left. Larry Kudlow, the White House economic advisor, said he does not foresee a recession in the next few years, maybe not until 2024, although many economists do think we are due for a recession soon.
Well, I think a lot of them think that the economy will slow. They think we've had this temporary boost from the tax cuts. But there's pretty widespread view at the Fed, you know, among private economists, that things will slow by 2020. But you don't hear a lot of them predicting at this point about an actual recession, though.
Right.
Who knows?
Jim Zarroli of NPR, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's Here and Now.
It's that time of year again when fans and industry professionals alike descend on San Diego for Comic-Con. There are now several comic conventions across the country throughout the year, but none compared to this annual event that started in 1970. And this year, more than 130,000 attendees will be there, but there are a few notable absences from the convention as well. Joining us now for what she's seeing in San Diego is NPR Books editor Petra Mayer. Hi, Petra.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, give us a feel. What have you seen at Comic-Con so far?
It's interesting. I'm seeing a lot of very scattered things. The big absences this year are Marvel and HBO. They don't have a huge presence here. Some Marvel TV shows are here. But so, you know, usually you can kind of tell what's pinging people's interest by watching the cosplayers, seeing who people are dressed up as. And I've seen a few Wonder Women, a few Black Panthers, some Rey from Star Wars, and a bunch of 13th Doctors from Doctor Who. But there's nothing really that, like, you know, reminds me of the year that maybe 300 came out and everywhere you looked there were Spartans. I do like to see always the people that have their own sort of personal private things that they love to cosplay. And you can tell that it's like not something that's right in the popular conscious right now, but it's something very meaningful to them. I saw a woman who was Pennywise the clown from It. She'd done a sort of feminized Pennywise costume and it was amazing and very creepy. And I like the joke costumes, too. I've seen a couple of dinosaur, those inflatable dinosaur suits, and usually they're referencing Jurassic Park. But this guy that I saw yesterday, he had a Thor outfit on over his dinosaur, so he was Dino Thor. He was pretty much
well,
my favorite.
As you... By the way, I just want to give a hat tip to all those people dressing up as the 13th Doctor from Doctor Who because she's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to say, so you mentioned that there are some big absences. Again, HBO, it doesn't have a big announcement this year. Neither does Marvel. I mean, how much is that absence being felt?
I think it's being felt a little bit. Certainly, I feel like the line for Hall H, and Hall H is the big ballroom that seats 6,500 people, and that's where all of the biggest TV shows and movies have their panels. And people, it's traditional, they line up for 2 days beforehand. They camp out, you know, the convention puts up special tents and people bring their little encampments with their coolers and their sleeping bags. And, you know, usually they're there to see whatever the big Marvel announcement is. This year, it was very mixed. The line seemed a little bit less intense. And people said they were there. A lot of them were there for Doctor Who, actually. Some people were interested in Predator. And a lot of people were interested in the upcoming Breaking Bad cast reunion. I did feel like there was a little bit of a gap. The mix of shows and movies that's being promoted is a little bit sort of odd. You know, you look around and there's The Good Place has a big installation. And then this new Jack Ryan show from Amazon. Castle Rock, the new Stephen King, J.J. Abrams show, has a big presence. But there isn't sort of one unifying thing that's going on.
Well, how important then is Comic-Con to the entertainment industry? Is it still sort of the big platform for major launches that it has been before?
I think it's hugely important. I mean, if you just look around at the amount of money that's clearly being poured into what's going on here, one of the things that's very peculiar to San Diego Comic-Con because it has so much outdoor space are what they call activations or immersive marketing. And these are these big sort of virtual reality experiences where you can go inside the world of your favorite show. And I just mentioned the Jack Ryan show. They have an entire city block downtown. I mean, I walked all around it, and of course it's blocked off so you can't really see what's going on inside. But apparently what it is you can go in there and go through a sort of training session where they teach you some combat and they teach you some like superhero, super agent skills. And then you get certified to help Jack Ryan on a mission in the field, and you go into a VR room that's basically like an escape room where they use Oculus Rift technology to put you in the middle of what I've heard is the pilot episode of the show. And it's this just enormous, elaborate installation. They have sort of recreated what looks like maybe a Turkish souk with like stalls and cushions and carpets that people are lounging around on all around this huge installation. I don't think they would do that if this venue wasn't major for them.
Yeah, good point. You going to try it out?
Oh my God, the lines. No, I can't. That's the other thing about Comic-Con is the lines. At one point on Wednesday, I was walking by the convention center and there's this huge line. And I asked a guard what it was for. And he said, everything. I don't know. That's basically the experience. You got to wait on a lot of lines if you want to do anything fun.
Well, NPR Books editor Petra Mayer speaking to us from San Diego, where she's attending Comic-Con, but not suffering the lines. Petra, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And this week, two channels started the second seasons of promising shows, NBC's courtroom comedy Trial and Error and FX's dark crime drama Snowfall. Both came back with new episodes yesterday. Summer is a time when most networks rely on reality TV or game shows to fill the airwaves. So could these returning series be an antidote to the doldrums of the summer season? NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is going to let us know. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
I know you've been looking forward to these shows, so let's tackle NBC's Trial and Error first, a lighthearted parody of true crime shows, you know, kind of the mockumentary style that The Office or Parks and Recreation made famous. So does this show, first of all, live up to those?
Well, that's a high bar.
Right.
Okay, so I won't say it's quite that good, but it's a really interesting premise. So basically, it's a comedy about this New York lawyer named Josh who comes to this town of East Peck, South Carolina. And in the first season, he was defending a character played by John Lithgow, this really eccentric guy who was accused of killing his wife. And now the second season, we're going to have Kristen Chenoweth playing a different character who's also accused of murder. The first season was more a satire of the movie called The Staircase, which is now a series on Netflix, an actual true crime documentary. And this season is supposed to be more of a satire of The Jinx, which is another true crime documentary that aired on HBO.
Okay.
So you can see they're going for something big here.
Okay. And if you want, you can, you know, research those. Although just to watch Kristen Chenoweth is good enough. She's the widely adored first lady of the town. And again, seems to have murdered her husband. Here's a clip.
Ma'am.
Is there a problem, officer?
Your tail light is out.
Oh, put it in the warning. Ta-ta.
Ta-ta. Also, you have a dead body in your trunk.
Oh, for f- sake, put it in a warning.
So tell us more about what she does in this show.
So if in the first season we had this guy who everybody thought was guilty, who kept doing things to make himself look guilty, even though he wasn't, in this one, everyone wants to believe that she's innocent and they love her to get away with this crime. And she just keeps doing things to reveal that she might actually be guilty of it. So it's a flip on what we originally saw. And of course, we all know Kristen Chenoweth is this sort of bubbly performer. And in this case, she's playing someone who's like that, but also has a bit of a dark side. She keeps doing these crazy things to reveal her possible guilt, even though everyone in the town seems to want to exonerate her. So right. it's an interesting comedy.
Well, boy, so that's Trial and Error, and they got something going for them because first Lithgow and now Chenoweth. So they're getting, you know, really A-list. Let's make a sharp turn to a very different show. FX's Snowfall, really dark crime drama. It traces the Los Angeles crack epidemic in the 80s. Here's a clip from the end of the first season, two characters talking about walking away from a murder.
It's the easiest thing in the world. Just turn around, walk out. Close the door behind you.
This isn't right.
This isn't right. This is a war, Daddy. We do what is required of us, which is exactly what I did that night at the house, and unfortunately what you are incapable of doing. So I'm doing this for both of us.
Yeah. Oh, talk about, yeah, that's grim.
That's pretty intense.
And what do you, how do they take on this terrible drug epidemic that ravaged communities across the country?
So Snowfall is an interesting storyline. It's trying to tell the tale of how crack first emerged in Los Angeles. And it started in three different areas. We saw a young black man who decides that he might be able to make a lot more money if he switched from trying to sell marijuana to selling cocaine, which wasn't being sold in black neighborhoods at that time. Then we also see a young Hispanic couple that are trying to get a foothold in the cocaine business. And then the third group is this guy from the CIA who wants to fund covert operations by facilitating the selling of drugs. And now in the second season, we see these three different camps of people come together more closely. In the first season, it was kind of hard at first to see how these three different groups of people were related and how does that add up to the crack epidemic. They weren't even making crack for much of the first season. Now crack exists. They're starting to sell it, and we're starting to see these networks of criminals and the CIA and covert operatives all work together to create this new drug trade that we know will eventually sweep through all of these neighborhoods and cause all kinds of pain and devastation. So it's a dark drama, but it is interesting, it's compelling, and some of the characters are very well drawn.
It sounds like you're saying for this and for Trial and Error, worth watching.
Most definitely. They're a little under the radar. I think people are paying more attention to higher profile shows, but they're both
like
very
CNN
entertaining.
Fox News.
Well, yeah. Yeah, we're to the point now where the cable news channels sort of feel like we're watching a scripted drama. But if you want to get away from those concerns and you want a story that will distract you, we have both a drama and a comedy that are both well done that are both coming to TV this week.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you.
Thank you.
Across the country, there's been a debate about Confederate monuments. Many people see them as racist, while others think they're meant to celebrate Southern pride and that removing them would erase history. Well, in a number of states, you can actually get the Confederate flag on your license plate. And in Tennessee, more people than ever are doing that. Joining us now by Skype is Natalie Allison, a reporter with The Tennessean. Natalie, where did these plates come from? Why is the state making a Confederate flag license plate?
The license plates are sponsored by the Sons of Confederate Veterans, which is an organization that has been around for a long time. It includes people who have ancestors who fought in the Civil War for the Confederacy. Tennessee isn't the only state that has them. There are eight others. It includes Alabama, North Carolina, Georgia, even Maryland. They all have Sons of Confederate Veterans commemorative plates. And what the Sons of Confederate Veterans have done in these states is they've gathered enough people who've said they would like to have these plates. The state has agreed to it. And a portion of the sales of those plates go towards the organization. And so in Tennessee, that's what they did in 2004, and they've offered them ever since.
And you spoke to somebody who has these plates on four of his vehicles. What did he say about why?
Yeah, that's right. So that's the commander of the statewide division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans in Tennessee. He told me that, you know, this was something that was important to them to do amid what he describes as anti-Confederate rhetoric in the last couple of years, as there's been a debate nationally over what to do with Confederate symbols. And in his perception, these symbols have come under fire in states like Tennessee and across the nation. And so for them, this is them taking a stand for what they believe is protecting heritage and also trying to encourage other people who are like-minded to donate to the cause.
Well, the reason that these symbols have come under attack is because many people view them as symbols of hate, as an endorsement of the history of the Confederacy, which includes slavery. You say that there's been an effort to get rid of these license plates before. The governor has condemned them, but nothing has happened so far. Why not?
Yeah, so this issue, of course, in Tennessee, became a source of contention in 2015 after the deadly shooting at Mother Emanuel in Charleston. It was then that, you know, reporters began asking our governor, Bill Haslam, you know, what do you think should be done about these plates? And in 2015, he said, you know, I think we should stop having these on our license plates in Tennessee, on state issued plates. And Democrats did introduce a bill to do that, and it never went anywhere. And then again, after Unite the Right in Charlottesville last summer, he was asked again, and he actually said he didn't realize until recently that we were still offering them, but that he still believed they should be banned in the state. But nothing has been done. I spoke with the senator who had introduced the bill in 2015, and she said her plan is to introduce it again this coming session.
So do you think it'll go anywhere?
It's hard to say. You know, in Tennessee, we are due to see some turnover in the state legislature. Right now, you know, there is a Republican supermajority, and it's very difficult to pass legislation like that. Tennessee, if you'll recall, was a state that twice this session declined to pass a resolution denouncing neo-Nazism. So something like this passing would require some definite turnover in the legislature.
That's Natalie Allison, a reporter with the Tennessean. Natalie, thank you.
Thanks so much, Jeremy.
You've heard us this week speak about Trump derangement syndrome. His backers define it as his critics suffering such distress over Donald Trump that they are being irrational with little regard to his actual positions. The phrase itself, though, comes from someone who is not a fan of Donald Trump, the late conservative commentator Charles Krauthammer, who first used it as Bush derangement syndrome in 2003, defining it then as the acute onset of paranoia in otherwise normal people in reaction to Bush policies, nay, he wrote, in reaction to his very existence. Well, he revised that to Trump derangement syndrome, a Trump-induced general hysteria producing an inability to distinguish between policy difference and signs of psychic pathology in the president. Andrew Bacevich, a retired Army colonel and military analyst, and like Krauthammer, no admirer of Trump, might agree. He joins us now by Skype. Andrew, hello.
Hello.
So you write about this in an op-ed for the Boston Globe this week. I want to start where you start, which is back much further than Krauthammer in 2003. You all go all the way back to 1964 and Richard Hofstadter's wonderful essay, The Paranoid Style in American Politics. Remind us why he wrote that. The context then was Goldwater, the candidate for president.
Yes. And the point of Professor Hofstadter's essay was that we have a penchant for this. We have a penchant for the paranoid style. It occurs periodically in our politics, and it has a tremendously distorting effect. And I think that in some respects, we are experiencing a similar phenomenon right now. I have to say, I was not familiar with Krauthammer's essay, and I think he said what I was trying to say much better than I said it.
Well, we'll get to what you want to say about this, but I just want to stay with Hofstadter for a second, because you sent me back to his writing. You said it's become something akin to essential reading again today, The Paranoid Style in American Politics. We'll link you to a reprinting of some of it in Harper's. There was a 300-page book. But it begins with him saying, American politics has often been an arena for angry minds. In recent years, we've seen angry minds at work mainly among extreme right-wingers who've now demonstrated in the Goldwater movement how much political leverage can be got out of the animosities and passions of a small minority. And he goes on to talk about, you know, the right at that time. That's pretty much what you're remembering, too.
It is, I believe, anger on the right, not confined to a small minority, anger on the right that led to the election of Donald Trump. The focus of my essay was to suggest that now that Trump is president, that has induced a paranoid response on the left among Trump's critics. Now, some people are going to object to the use of the term paranoid. I was only using it in the way that Professor Hofstadter did.
Well, but you go on to say, induce this paranoid response, one that, unless curbed, may well pose a greater danger to the country than Trump himself. Make that case.
Well, I mean, Trump has certainly distorted our politics in ways that I certainly don't approve of. But I fear that this obsessive response to Trump deepens that distortion, and that the events of the past couple of weeks, the G7, the NATO summit, the Helsinki summit, all illustrate this problem.
Yeah. So you're saying that there's an overreaction, and some could say, you look at CNN, there's very few things other than President Trump. But on the other hand, we in the press could say, well, wait a second, you have a president who says things like, no, I didn't say that about Theresa May of Britain, when in fact he did, or says, no, I didn't say I don't think Russia was involved in our elections, when in fact he did say that. What are we to do with that? Not cover it?
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that at all. I mean, so much of what the president says is utter nonsense. And it's important to call him on it. But I think it's also necessary to think about what happens next. So we have a president who makes all of these extraordinary statements about NATO, suggesting that the United States is about to withdraw from NATO, that the whole alliance system is going to collapse. And then lo and behold, that doesn't happen. So, yes, we should take cognizance of the idiotic things that he says. But I think it's equally important to recognize that much of what he says actually doesn't end up producing any substantive change. Well, we're still in NATO. There still are sanctions on the Russians for their annexation of the Crimea. The G7 is still up and running. I'm not defending the president. I think his statements are beyond counterproductive, but it doesn't mean the end of the world.
Well, you also point out that even though people were very fearful of Trump's revival of America First and what seemed like isolationism, there are still U.S. troops deployed to Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, other places around the world. And we always point out that you lost a son in service in Iraq. So this is something obviously very important to you.
But, well, if I may, that is an excellent illustration of the problem. So we have a president who embarrasses us, but we also have an approach to policy, one that predates Trump, that Trump, despite what he promised to do as a candidate, is in fact affirming. And I refer here to our endless wars. And I would argue that that is a far greater scandal than anything that happened at Helsinki, that what members of the press ought to be grabbing onto with the same sort of fierceness that they grab onto his stupid remarks is, how can it possibly be that we are lodged in this condition of permanent war? That's what people should be writing about, talking about, arguing about every day, not Trump's latest mishap.
Yeah.
I find it inexplicable that so many people voted for Trump, but the complaints that led so many people to vote for Trump are legitimate complaints. And that's where the attention of our political system, of our media, ought to be, on those grievances.
And resist 24/7 coverage, even though it's extraordinarily important, of families separated at the border, or his seeming embrace of white nationalists in a rally, or talking about immigration changing the fabric of Europe. I mean, it goes on. And you're saying pay attention to, try to shift your gaze elsewhere, including...
Well, no, yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is pay attention to more than Trump. I mean, somebody sent me a note and said, the American people have very limited bandwidth when it comes to public affairs. And it seems to me that we are allowing Trump to suck up more of that bandwidth than he deserves.
One of the problems you mentioned that might have paved the way for his election, radical changes in the nation's moral landscape. I know what I think you meant by that, but what did you mean by that?
What I mean is that our culture is moving rapidly in a direction away from what we might call traditional norms derived from our Judeo-Christian religious traditions. And a lot of people think that that's fine, necessary. But I think it's fair to recognize that there are quite a number of our fellow citizens who are uneasy with these changes. We're never going to go back to the 1950s. We shouldn't go back to the 1950s. But it seems necessary, if we're ever going to bring the country back together again, to at least acknowledge that people whose values derive from the 1950s at least deserve a certain hearing, a certain amount of respect. And I think that, again, is one of those issues that demands a heck of a lot more attention than the president's latest gaffe.
Right. And just to be clear, you're not saying gays and lesbians should wait, just as some people thought that blacks should wait in the 60s. It's not time yet. You're not saying that. You're saying the people who find this frightening, this what is very swift in historical times, not fast enough for a lot of people, but in historical times it is swift. You're saying that there somehow should be some more understanding and compassion towards people who are finding this moving quickly.
You just said it much better than I did.
Well, because it sounds like you're saying if Americans don't help their fellow Americans with that, then someone will take advantage of their pain.
As Trump did, and as potentially other Trumps will.
That's military analyst Andrew Bacevich, always thought-provoking. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has been harshly criticized after an interview he gave to Recode's Kara Swisher earlier this week. It was a wide-ranging conversation about Russian interference in the 2016 election, the spread of false information, and what kind of policies Facebook has in place to combat hate speech and violence that might result. One comment in particular drew criticism. Zuckerberg was talking about misinformation that appears on Facebook and how the company responds to it. He offered this example.
Right. Okay. So I'm Jewish. Mm-hmm. And there's a set of people who deny that the Holocaust happened.
Yes,
right.
A lot.
I find that deeply offensive. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I don't believe that our platform should take that down, because I think that there are things that different people get wrong. I don't think that they're intentionally getting it wrong, but I think that
in the case of the Holocaust deniers, they might be. But go ahead.
It's hard to impugn intent.
Zuckerberg later clarified that comment. Today, a spokesperson for Germany's justice ministry said the government won't allow posts denying the Holocaust on Facebook, since Holocaust denial is a criminal offense in Germany. We're joined now by Kara Swisher of Recode. She's in San Francisco. Hi, Kara.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. And first, just your thoughts on those comments about the Holocaust and then the clarification from Zuckerberg.
Well, you know, it's a complex topic, and he was trying to make a larger point about Facebook being, an open platform for everybody. And I think the difficulty is that it's difficult. It's a difficult issue. It's an ethical issue. It's a question. It has a lot of emotion around it. And, you know, Mark is part of sort of a cadre in Silicon Valley of people that are debating this issue around First Amendment, around the ability of people to speak, even if they're speaking horrible things. And I think it's hard for that company to differentiate between things that are wrong, things that are false, and things that are actually malignant. And it's hard for them to make these choices. And so they don't want to, and so they've gotten themselves into this mess.
Well, and the thing that started all of this in this talk about whether they need to be policing the content on Facebook more had to do with whether they should allow InfoWars, to publish what it publishes on Facebook, including saying that the Sandy Hook school shooting was fake. Why is that so hard for Facebook to say, we're not going to allow that on here?
Well, they use their slippery slope argument, which a lot of these First Amendment absolutists use. And, you know, what's really happening here is the weaponization of the First Amendment. I keep thinking about this a lot in that there's obviously, as a journalist, First Amendment is first for me. But at the same time, there are some really edge cases here. Should, you know, if you have a platform, do you really need to give voice to Holocaust deniers or people that are just malignantly talking about Sandy Hook as if it's an acting exercise? You know, these poor children were killed and these parents are suffering, and to allow this to happen is an affront. And the question is, the issue is Facebook has to make some choices or else stick to this really strong notion that they'll put anything up. I don't remember the exact quote by Abraham Lincoln. It was like, if you accept something, if you do something, you fall for anything. It's a really hard and difficult issue for Facebook to face. And if Mark's going to have this point of view, which I think is very muddled, he's going to have to deal with the controversy that erupts when he talks about it.
Are his competitors dealing with this same thing right now? I mean, is Twitter? I feel like it's always Facebook, though, that's at the center of this storm.
Well, Facebook's at the center because it's the biggest and it's the most influential. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, if you want to rob a bank, it's because that's where the money is. And so that's why all these malignant actors are being attracted to this platform, because one is that it's easy to manipulate. The tools are fantastic if you want to lie. And it's huge. It has 2 billion people. Half the, you know, huge amount of the world is on Facebook. And so that's why. But, you know, if Twitter's got this problem, spent a lot of time not policing the site. It recently removed, I don't know, 70 million accounts, which is enormous. Mm-hmm. But why didn't they do that before? YouTube has the same issue as all these videos that are really disturbing and what they should and shouldn't allow to be uploaded to their platform. Snapchat doesn't have this problem because they're very good about policing. They've made choices of who's allowed on the platform and who isn't. So that's the question here. Are you going to be someone who monitors a platform, or are you going to be someone that lets, you know, all hell break loose? And I think that's what Facebook has chosen, and that's what they're getting.
Kara, there's another election coming in just a few months. Did Zuckerberg give you any assurance that Facebook is prepared this time to prevent Russian or other interference?
Yeah, I mean, he talked about that, all the efforts they're making in that area. And, you know, there's 89 other minutes besides this particular quote. And I think I really do appreciate that he took that much time and wanted to keep talking. Someone who's the most powerful person in tech, really, is thoughtful. He's very thoughtful and very earnest. And I appreciate that he at least showed up. And I'm not— last interview with him and I was very tough too last time. He sweat a lot. It was a very famous interview. So I give him that credit. But yeah, he talked about the idea of what they're doing. And I talked a lot about is, why didn't you anticipate this stuff before? They don't seem to anticipate very much about the human condition of what could happen on Facebook. But he seemed to be, you know, working really hard to prevent that. I don't know if it's possible, but at least they're aware of it. And this is an issue that Facebook shouldn't be facing alone. Our government should be doing this with them. And obviously, the person at the head of the government doesn't believe this occurs. We don't know what he believes, actually. It keeps changing every hour. But obviously, most of the intelligence, our government should be involved in this. This is an attack on democracy. So we'll see if he and they together can make it work.
It's Kara Swisher, co-founder of Recode. You can find her full interview on the Recode site. Kara, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Here and Now.